Maybe I would feel differently if I were black. That's a quote from a former Little Leaguer in the documentary from a few years ago entitled A Long Time Coming, a 1955 baseball story. This is Bob Villa from Florida, and along with my co-host from California, Rob Comus, we will be discussing this topic and others in our continuing exploration of racism in America. In 1955, when racial segregation defined the South, two groups of 12-year-old boys stepped onto a baseball field in a nonviolent act of cultural defiance that, in a tiny way, would change the course of history. So, Rob, welcome, and this is where I want to start.
Yes, welcome. How about giving a brief synopsis of the movie? And then we can circle back to the opening line of the podcast.
Picture, 1955, an historic Florida Little League regional game between a black team and the only white team in the region willing to play them. You know, in the background of this is the Jim Crow South, where 14-year-old Emmett Till had been lynched that very year in Mississippi, and where blacks couldn't use whites-only restrooms, water fountains, restaurants, or hotels. The boys on the JCs, which was the Pensacola black team, now in their 70s, recount the thrill of finally being able to play in the largely white Little League, and the disappointment after winning their division only to learn that white teams were refusing to play them in the district and regional playoffs. With each forfeiture, the JCs advanced, as per Little League rules, only to be disinvited from playing at the next level. Then it came to a team in Orlando, and one of the white Orlando team coaches actually resigned rather than lead his team against the black boys. But the other coach, who had a kid playing for the team, had no problem with the integration.
How did the kids feel about playing the game?
Well, the kids, both black and white, they just wanted to play. And so 8 years after Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in Major League Baseball, the all-black Pensacola JCs and the all-white Orlando Kiwanis moved past threats and fears to integrate youth sports in the South.
And the game itself?
The JCs were no match for the Kiwanis, and the JCs wound up losing unceremoniously 5-0. Now, in the documentary, which was made in 2018, there are interviews with men from both teams, and they offer their views on racism and the importance of the experience they shared. It conveniently juxtaposed these two sides, these two teams, these two radically divergent points of views. What the documentary becomes is an examination of the extremes in society. How small town America could represent simpler, safer times. Yet on the other end of the spectrum, it conjures up image of repression and relegation. Some members of the white team admit that segregation so separated the races back in the 50s, that there was little opportunity to mix with or know blacks as people when they were kids. Totally allowing ignorance to foster prejudice. One admits that his parents were prejudiced and he didn't want to grow up like them. But others, they use their lack of interaction with blacks to excuse inexplicable views, including comments that today blacks are no longer affected by prejudice, despite plentiful statistical evidence to the contrary.
What did the guys from the black team have to say?
Well, one example that stood out for me was that a black team member was moved simply by the fact that these white team members were willing to meet with them so many years later. Now back to the other white players. One of them stated he can't understand, again, this is 2018, he can't understand the need for a Black Lives Matter movement, arguing that all lives should matter, ignoring multiple police shootings of unarmed black people and also the way that centuries of banning blacks from good schools, good jobs, and good opportunities have disadvantaged an entire race.
When I hear these comments, I am just reminded how so very far we still have to go to achieve equality in this country. I guess it just saddens me.
Yes, these Southern white men in their 70s who profess the need to love everyone still can't understand all the black anger. And then comes a statement from one white player who ended his comments about not understanding what is going on in America today regarding racism, simply states, "Maybe I would feel differently if I were black."
That really is a powerful statement. Empathy is such a powerful antidote for so much.
The movie ends on an impromptu meeting of a dozen of the surviving players as they gather in the opposing dugouts on the same field they played back in 55. And then they engage in an old-fashioned pickup game. Hugs all around. Yeah, a feel-good moment, but for me, it just can't erase the comments that these men made just a few years ago. Which leads me to my summer reading, Rob. I've gone back to a familiar source, Professor Ibram X. Kendi. Now, our listeners may recall How to Be an Anti-Racist, which he wrote back in 2018. His current book, with a very similar sounding name, is How to Raise an Anti-Racist. And it's a call to keep fighting for a world where skin color matters as little to your chances of success as life or hair or eye color. Now, lest you think that I consider everything he writes as gospel, there are a few areas that I can't quite agree with.
Do tell, old friend.
Well, specifically, his basic refusal to extend good faith to his critics. To me, the most concerning part of Kendi's book, I feel, was his consistent attacks on his critics' motives. People who disagree with Kendi's preferred policy positions are racist, and racist ideas just seem to be those he personally doesn't like. He argues that a key reason millions of men and women hated Hillary Clinton in 2016 was gender racism. He also dismisses black people who disagree with him as contributing to the black-on-black crime of internalized racism. Now, these criticisms aside, what jumps out at me was about midway through the book, he discusses empathy, which is what I reflect upon when I hear the statement, "Maybe I would feel differently if I were black." Kendi states, "Empathy requires some imagination. To imagine the situation was even more intimate. Your relatives are dying from police violence at a much higher rate than my relatives. How would you feel if every time you expressed empathetic concern about your relatives being murdered, I showed indifference?" Now, Kendi's book is both a memoir and a call to action. It really emphasizes that, well, all adults need to engage with the kids that they love in important conversations about race. In a nutshell, yeah, even the littlest kids can learn to be anti-racist. As youngsters, they should be learning not to judge anyone by the color of their skin. Kendi writes, "When kids point out differences in skin color and hair color and textures and cultures, etc., teachers and parents and caregivers should not silence them. Those are the moments. Those are the opportunities to teach, to acknowledge the difference, to appreciate the differences, to convey that though people may be different, they are equal."
We spent a good deal of time in episode 8 on the educational process. We said the good teaching and learning guides students to a place where the student must push through levels of discomfort in order to reach new insights and understanding. Good teaching also requires that the teachers, other students, the community provide the support to help the student navigate their discomfort and to achieve growth.
But then here is the next moment that's important. that here in Florida, and unfortunately many other places around the country, policymakers are refusing to do just that. This past April, Florida's governor signed legislation that aims to regulate how schools can address race and gender. The law, which is commonly known as Stop Woke Act, is the governor's way of limiting the way race-related issues can be taught in schools. Now, Kendi wrote this book before this law was enacted. However, he gives some damn good reasons why it should not have happened. In his book, he continues, "We should take the conversation with kids a step further and talk about the bad rules making life harder for dark-skinned people and how those rules are wrong and racist. Whatever racial inequity our children see, we can engage them on it." And to me, this is what makes Florida and its new laws about education so harmful to students. Florida has banned schools from teaching subjects that would cause white people to feel guilt or discomfort on account of their race. In essence, if hearing about slavery would make a white kid feel guilty, then it can't be discussed. Now, how can teachers be sure of a discussion of disturbing events like slavery won't make some kids uncomfortable?
It would appear that teachers have an impossible task if they need to discuss the 200 plus years of slavery in America under such circumstances.
And Kendi doubles down on this. He says, "What students are not learning, the absences in their education, can be more harmful than what they are learning. Educators teach when they don't teach. The duality of hardly teaching about racism and about what lives of people of color standardizers an education of racist ideas. When students don't learn the racist policy behind the racial inequity in their communities, it can lead them to believe that white people have more because they are more. The racist ideas are reinforced when students see white people more in their curricula." Kendi points out that Black Americans are often held up by, and both whites and blacks, as standard bearers of their race. You know, that's quite a burden put on anybody, and burdens lots of white people might not know anything about, since we're rarely held to the same collectivist standard. I'll tell you, when I was in school, and I was not doing well in school, as an example, the only standard I was held up to was against was my older brother. Anyway, Kendi concludes his book this way. "The ultimate way to protect our children from racism is to protect all children from racism. The ultimate way to protect all children from racism is to eliminate racism. And to do that, we have to do more than raise anti-racist children. We have to raise an anti-racist society." So, and I agree, we need to raise an anti-racist society. It wouldn't hurt to put ourselves in someone else's shoes, to pause and think, maybe I would feel differently if I were Black.
So, thanks for the summary of the Kendi book, and very importantly, for the critical summary. A summary that shows thoughtful analysis that does not blindly accept all that the author has expressed. And I'm thinking that perhaps even without ever mentioning the word racism, if we could teach people to think in a similar manner, to think and to act critically, much of what ails this aching world might fall by the wayside. My research has taken me to a book by the French columnist Thomas Piketty. In, quote, "A Brief History of Inequality," end quote, Piketty cites compelling data to first describe socioeconomic inequality historically, and then to propose solutions for the future. Explaining a basic premise of Piketty's approach to his research, he writes, quote, "Used properly, moderately, and critically, The language of socioeconomic indicators is an indispensable complement to the natural language for fighting intellectual nationalism, escaping the manipulations of economic elites, and building a new egalitarian horizon." End quote. I had initially started working from the California Reparations Task Force report, which calls for the reparations to Black Americans. The report is said to be the most comprehensive look at race since the 1968 Kerner Commission, which I might add is a remarkable report that is unfortunately an accurate description of the role of race in America both in 1968 and in 2022. Having said that, while California often leads the country in terms of being socially progressive, California can also be seen as much too far to the left to be taken seriously by those on the right, or even those in the middle. And quite frankly, although I would characterize myself as a left-leaning progressive, I too find some of the verbiage that comes from their our representatives just too extreme. Given that, I thought perhaps looking at the point of view of an economist might give a more balanced look at the notion of reparations and inequality overall. And that is what brought me to the Piketty book.
Okay. So where does he begin?
One of the first important points Piketty makes is that the world, although still profoundly socioeconomically unequal, is significantly less unequal than it was 100 or 200 years ago. To support this claim, Piketty writes, quote, "Concretely, the richest 1% share of total private property is currently 2 times smaller than it was a century ago, but it still remains on the order of 5 times larger than the share held by the poorest 50%, who today own scarcely more than 5% of the total, despite the fact that they are, by definition, 50 times more numerous than the richest 1%. In reality, the deconcentration of property was made almost exclusively to the benefit of social groups situated between the richest 1% and the poorest 50%. But it was of very little benefit to the latter, who virtually never owned anything and still don't own anything. To put it another way, the poorest 50% are perhaps still as poor in the sense that their share of total property has scarcely risen since the 19th century. But they are a little less at the mercy of property owners, employers, landlords, husbands, colonists, than they used to be." End quote.
Wow. Okay. I'm processing all of that. Could you summarize what all of this means?
To summarize, the richest 1% are still very rich, but not as rich. The middle class, which now owns property, and with it socioeconomic status, was created. And the poor, while still not being able to share in the benefits of owning property, have gained some rights and privileges they did not have 100 years ago.
Some rights and privileges.
Exactly. Here, Piketty emphasizes that while owning property is a relatively simple measure of wealth, with it comes what he refers to as a, quote, bundle of rights, end quote, generally not afforded those who do not own property. More simply, he states that, quote, property is always a relationship of power, end quote. And so it is that Piketty argues that the world is more equal, but still profoundly unequal. Next, Piketty poses the following question, quote, how did Europe and the United States attained such a dominant position on a global level, at least until recently, end quote. And in short, his answer is as follows, quote, although no single explanation exists, we shall see that slavery and colonialism played a central role in the Western world's acquisition of wealth. Today, the distribution of wealth among countries, as well as within them, is still deeply marked by this heritage, end quote. This brief answer, for which I will provide an overview of his justification for holding such a view, is consistent with the research Bob, you and I have been grappling with for some time.
You got it. We've spent a number of episodes dissecting the results of slavery and the centuries of racism and the, you know, economic impact it has had on persons of color.
Piketty's argument begins with the observation that, quote, around 1750 to 1800, the most advanced regions of China and Japan were in a state of development comparable to the corresponding regions of Western Europe, end quote. Several key factors would soon contribute significantly to the Western world's acquisition of wealth and power. First, the competition between European states required that each state develop a strong military. And, Piketty suggests, that deforestation of the European continent required the development of new technologies that advanced the West sociologically and militarily. Second, the military dominance these states achieved enabled the spread of colonialism. This in turn gave the states access to natural and human resources. Military power allowed the colonizers to take from their colonies whatever natural resources and human resources needed to satisfy their wants and needs. Piketty writes that the, quote, industrial revolution, beginning in the United Kingdom at the end of the 18th century and spreading throughout Europe over the course of the 19th century, was fueled by the large-scale extraction of raw materials, especially cotton, and of energy sources, particularly wood, from the rest of the world, all within the framework of a coercive and colonialist organizational scheme, end quote.
Well, that certainly describes America. Recently, I read a report from the History Channel that by the start of the Civil War, the South was producing about 75% of the world's cotton. And it created more freaking millionaires per capita in Mississippi Valley than anywhere else in the country.
And Piketty further writes that, quote, the fiscal and military abilities of the European states, emerging from their past rivals, largely strengthened by the technological and financial innovations proceeding from competition among states, allowed them to organize an international division of labor and supply that was particularly profitable, end quote. These citations from the book, to me, disguise the role slavery played by representing them here as taking, quote, human resources, end quote, and organizing, quote, an international division of labor, end quote, in order to increase profits. That is a function of my representation of his work, not of how the book describes the history. Piketty writes in great deal about the American slave trade, the French colonization and resulting slavery of native peoples of La Réunion, Martinique, Guadeloupe, French Guiana, and Haiti. The French and the Dutch colonization and enslavement of African countries, and the British colonization and domination of their broad and expansive empire. We will discuss Piketty's more nuanced and humanistic look at the results of these practices that fueled Western expansion and devastated so many peoples and their countries. Piketty continues with, quote, the reality is that we have just emerged from the colonial experiment. It would be naive to imagine that its effects can be erased in just a few decades, end quote. And, quote, those who are born today are not individually responsible for this burdensome heritage, but we are all responsible for the way in which we choose or fail to take into account in analyzing the world economic system, its injustices, and the need for change, end quote.
That's a powerful statement, but not enough people or governments are willing to take on that responsibility. So, what would you say are other topics in the book that really jump out at you?
Two points made by Piketty are particularly salient to me. The first is that while from a purely legal perspective, slavery ended in most of these colonies and countries many decades ago, oppressive policies that effectively preserved the power of the oppressor over the oppressed were designed and implemented in virtually every instance. We have documented the Jim Crow laws, both de facto and de jure, that effectively segregated and suppressed the African-American population in both the South and the North in this podcast. But we in America were hardly alone in our ability to do so.
Oh, absolutely. in the Western Hemisphere alone, up until the 1850s, slavery was still legal in Ecuador, New Granada, Argentina, Peru, Venezuela, and it did remain legal in many other Caribbean and South America countries until the 1870s.
And Piketty's key point here is that in all these countries where de jure slavery ended, de facto slavery took over. Regarding France's colonization of Haiti and enslavement of its people, Piketty writes, quote, although in 1825 France finally agreed to accept the country's independence and to put an end to its threats to send troops to invade the island, that was only because Charles X had obtained from the Haitian government a commitment to repay to France a debt of 150 million gold francs to indemnify the slaveholders for their loss of property, end quote. And Piketty continues, quote, for more than a century, from 1825 to 1950, the price that France tried to make Haiti pay for its freedom had one main consequence. The island's development was overdetermined by the question of the indemnity, which was sometimes violently denounced and sometimes accepted with resignation, according to the ebb and flow of endless political cycles. End quote. So even though the people were legally free, they were tethered to political and economic whims of the French. And the country suffered for this for over 100 years. More generally speaking, Piketty writes, quote, in post-slavery colonial societies, the mechanisms of inequality take different forms, in particular through a legal, social, fiscal, and educational system that is profoundly discriminatory, end quote. And specifically in France, he writes that, quote, research like that of Emmanuel Sada on the French Empire has shown how until the middle of the 20th century, the colonial powers developed specific legal systems in their empires, allowing them to grant rights based on ethno-racial categories that they set about codifying with precision, even though with the abolition of slavery, these categories were supposed to have been eliminated from metropolitan France, end quote.
Hey, we were quite good at developing similar systems in the U.S. One of the forms of legalized involuntary servitude common in the American South from the 1880s through the 1940s was called convict leasing. And it was primarily used to justify the continued social and economic exploitation of African Americans after the Emancipation Proclamation. They were able to do so by exploiting the criminal conviction loophole in the 13th Amendment's wording. For years, the state of Florida down here took advantage of the long-standing convict leasing system. And it wasn't ended until 1923, in part spurred on by the public pressure, which resulted from the widespread publicity surrounding the killing of a prisoner, a white prisoner, by the way.
Piketty adds, quote, in South Africa, discrimination took an extremely brutal form. With the Native Land Act of 1913, the black population was de facto confined to reserves representing 7% of South Africa's territory. Black workers were forbidden to leave their zone of employment without a special pass. These measures were further radicalized with apartheid, which was officially instituted in 1948 and implemented until 1990. The legal systems in force were not always as extreme as in the case of South Africa, but in the various colonial contexts, the colonized populations were de facto systematically deprived of access to employment, education, and property equal to that enjoyed by the colonists. End quote. In focusing on the British Empire, Piketty writes, quote, we must also remember that in practice, there is a continuum between pure slavery and the various forms of more or less forced labor. After the abolition of slavery, the British and French authorities developed new systems allowing them to bring in workers from more distant sources, in particular from India in the case of Réunion and Mauritius by means of long-term contracts. In the French case, these were called engage, and in the British case, indentured workers.
Uh-huh. So how did the British do this?
For Indian workers, this, quote, commitment, end quote, consisted in paying over a long period, for example, 10 years, a large part of their wages to their employers to reimburse the latter for the cost of transporting them. That's rich. In the event that an employee's performance was deemed insufficient or worse yet, lacking in discipline, the repayment obligation could be prolonged by 10 additional years or more. The legal archives have been preserved, and it is evident that in the context in which the judicial system is strongly biased in favor of the employers, can lead to forms of exploitation and arbitrariness that are, to be sure, different from hardcore slavery, but not infinitely distant from it. The available resources also clearly show how employers and courts negotiate, so to speak, the transformation of the system of discipline at work. The property owners gradually agreed to reduce the use of corporal punishment, which was common under slavery, but on the condition that the legal authorities help them impose financial sanctions that can result in similar subjugation, end quote.
Well, in his research, did Piketty uncover anything at all, any organization or any law that might have been put in place to fight these practices?
Somewhat. To combat these oppressive policies, the International Labor Organization, ILO, was founded in 1919. The constitution of the ILO stressed social justice as a necessary condition to achieving a universal and lasting peace, and as a necessary condition for poorer, less powerful countries to better the lives of their people. The ILO made a, quote, series of recommendations and reports regarding the length of the workday and its dangers, the setting of wages, and the rights of workers and their representatives. However, the ILO lacked the means and power to impose sanctions to ensure that its recommendations were implemented, end quote. The impotence of the ILO is illustrated through the following example. Piketty writes, quote, "Whenever the French administration's favorite arguments was that many of the alleged offenses, particularly on the Congo Ocean Railway, concerned not forced labor, but rather military conscription, which was one of the few forms of unpaid labor authorized by the ILO, on the condition, however, that the military system not be misused to carry on civilian tasks. In this case, the ILO suspected France of doing just that. Outraged by such an infringement on what they considered to be their, quote, national sovereignty, end quote, the French authorities refused to ratify the ILO's convention in 1930, end quote. So simple. If you do not like the rules that say you should treat people justly, well, then just say that you don't want to play by those rules.
Well. It certainly appears that with centuries of their colonialism ingrained in their culture, the French just couldn't accept that they needed to change their ways.
Yeah, well, people in power do not like to yield their power. But just to pile on the French a bit more, Piketty writes, quote, "Concretely, up to the last day of the colonial empire, quote, Algerian Muslims, end quote, and other indigenous populations never had the same rights as the colonists, whether political rights or social and economic rights. In particular, the school system remained deeply segregated right up to the end, in the sense that the schools open to the colonists and the natives were usually strictly separated in accord with the modalities that, if not exactly the same as in southern states, were hardly more egalitarian, end quote.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly like the U.S. I mean, you know, the 60s with the private schools that opened up because of the school integration. It's exactly like the United States.
Piketty cites data that quantifies the educational disparity. Quote, "The The ratio between the expenditure for education of the colonists' children and the expenditure for the children of the colonized was 40 to 1, end quote. Now, actually, that would be quite appropriate if the ratio of colonists' children to the children of the colonized was also 40 to 1. However, only 15.2% of the population was European, mostly French, while the majority of the population, that is over 50%, were indigenous Algerian Muslims. Hardly a 40 to 1 ratio, more like 1 to 4, 1 to 6. In short, the oppression of colonized people or native populations took many forms. But in the end, the outcome was the same. Oppressor reaps the economic rewards while the oppressed suffer long-lasting and often devastating consequences. The second main point I would like to highlight is the case Piketty makes for reparations. While Piketty makes a strong economic case for reparations, I believe at the foundation of his argument it is more based on social justice. Regarding the question of reparations, he writes, quote, "No matter how complex this question is, it cannot be evaded forever. It is time to act unless we want deep and lasting injustice to continue. More generally, a colonial heritage of slaveholding forces us to rethink the connection between reparatory justice and universalist justice all over the world." Just cannot get that word right.
Yeah. Now, one of the main arguments against reparations is purely about the cost. Governments, organizations, states, whatever. Everyone will say it's just too expensive.
Sure. And yet, countries have for centuries found ways to compensate slaveholders for their financial losses after the abolition of slavery. Countries paid reparations to the slaveholders, but not to the slaves. Consider the process for compensating British slaveholders for after abolition in Britain. Piketty writes, quote, "In practice, the law of abolition passed by the British Parliament in 1833 put in place full compensation for property owners. Relatively sophisticated scales were drawn up on the basis of the slave's age, gender, and productivity, so that the compensation might be as fair and as exact as possible. In this way, some 20 million pounds of sterling, or about 5% of the United Kingdom's national income at the time, was paid to 4,000 slaveholders. Today, if a government decided to devote to such a policy the same proportion of the British national income, it would have to pay approximately 120 billion euros, or about 39 million euros on average for each of the 4,000 property owners. Here we are talking about owners with very large holdings, often several hundred slaves and sometimes several thousand. All of this was financed by a corresponding increase in the public debt, which was itself paid by all British taxpayers, but in practice, mainly by modest mid-level households, given the great regressiveness of the financial system, which was based principally on indirect taxes," end quote. And the slaves received nothing other than a slew of laws that effectively enslaved them, not just in the name of slavery. And while people argue that compensating oppressed people is too complex, they certainly were quite capable of dealing with the complexity of compensating the oppressors, the slaveholders. As we have discussed in previous episodes, the U.S. government gave away millions of acres of land in the Midwest to white people. The U.S. government could afford the GI Bill and housing loans to families in the 1940s and 1950s. Again, mostly to white people.
Oh, yes. Although the GI Bill guaranteed low-interest mortgages and other loans, they were not administered by the VA itself. Thus, the VA could co-sign, but not actually guarantee the loans. And so this gave white-run financial institutions free rein to refuse mortgages and loans to black people, which became the practice commonly known as redlining.
And redline they did. And of course, freed slaves were promised 40 acres and a mule after the Civil War, but that was a promise never kept. In fact, there are plenty of examples of reparations being distributed to those who suffer injustice. Piketty writes, quote, "In 2021, the city of Evanston, Illinois, adopted a program of reparations to be paid to the Black population, with individual payments of as much as $25,000 in order to help purchase housing. That may seem modest, given the immense concentration of wealth in the United States, and in particular the size of racial inequalities in terms of assets and the magnitude of damages suffered during slavery and then segregation, but this may be a start. Spoilization of Jewish property perpetrated by the Nazi authorities during World War II, for which restitution procedures are ongoing, in particular since the creation of the Matteoli Mission in France in 1997. The heirs of the Hohenzollern, the Prussian royal family, which fell from power in 1918, are currently suing the German state for residences and works of art for which they claim they were insufficiently indemnified. We could also mention the Civil Liberties Act of 1988 in the United States, according to $20,000 to each of the Japanese Americans interned during World War II.
Well, here in Florida, and I'm actually going to say something nice about the history of Florida. Here in Florida in 1994, it amazingly became the first state to consider compensating victims of racial violence. In this case, it was the victims of the Rosewood Massacre. The Rosewood Massacre was a racially motivated massacre of Black people and the destruction of a Black town that took place during the first week of January 1923 in rural Levy County, Florida. Now, it took years of investigating, reporting, and publicity to force the issue. And finally, 70 years after the massacre, the Rosewood Compensation Bill included $2.1 million to compensate survivors and their descendants.
And in Santa Monica, California, a pilot program offering below market rate housing to minorities displaced by urban renewal projects of the 1950s and 1960s is perhaps a small step, but surely an important step in the right direction. Quote, "It is definitely positive and addresses one of the most egregious inequalities, the decimation of Black communities," end quote, said Ron Daniels, convener of the New York-based National African American Reparations Commission. Quote, "The people making these decisions in the past called it urban renewal, but in our communities, it was known as Negro removal. And we are still feeling the consequences today," end quote. And also in California, Charles and Willa Bruce had established a profitable business with a beach resort, opened in 1912, in Manhattan Beach. Bruce's beach became an ocean beach destination for Black people when segregation prohibited them from enjoying other beach access. For the next 12 years, the Bruces built a thriving business until the city seized the property in 1924 under the claims of needing the land to build a public park, which was not built until the 1960s. Bruce's beach was formally returned to the descendants of the Bruces, and they now lease the land back to the city for $413,000 per year. And that is a huge step in the direction of justice. But Piketty argues that reparations will not be enough. He writes,
quote, "To repair the damage done by racism and colonialism, we also have to change the economic system on a systemic basis, by reducing inequalities and ensuring that everyone has the most egalitarian access possible to education, employment, and property, independently of his or her origins. To fight discrimination, we must also pursue policies that are as ambitious, coherent, and verifiable as possible, but without rigidifying identities, which are always plural and multidimensional," end quote.
As such, Piketty says that, quote, "Each country, each citizen on the planet, should have some part of the tax revenues derived from multinational companies and the world's billionaires. First, because each human being should have a minimal equal right to health care, education, and development. Second, because the rich countries' prosperity would not exist without the poor countries. The growth of wealth in the Western world, like that in Japan or China, has long been based on international division of labor and the feverish exploitation of natural and human resources worldwide. End quote. So maybe it is not so difficult to compensate those whose ancestors suffered at the hands of the oppressors. Maybe we just need the will to do so. And I think very importantly, we must not let the perfect be the enemy of the good, or even let the perfect be the enemy of the better than doing nothing at all.
Well, thanks, Rob, for some really intense and deep research. Well, folks, we'll continue to do research and study in our journey, in our examination of racism in America. And a final thing, just getting back to the documentary that I mentioned in the beginning, which was entitled A Long Time Coming, a 1955 Baseball Story. It's on a few of the streaming services. I recommend that folks check it out. Rob, thanks. Until we meet again.
And thank you, Bob. See you next time.